Moncrief on News Talk.
Jonathan De Burka Butler is with us once again to bring some stories from other parts of the world that don't involve the word tariff. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Sean, I wish I could have kept that promise.
I wish you could, because the very first story involves tariffs. We're going to Africa, the Sahel, specifically. Why are they doing this now?
Yeah, so as if you hadn't had enough already about tariffs, they're imposing them now in West Africa. So this is West African neighbours Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, who have come together, and they have announced a 0.5 levy on imported goods, right? So these three countries have been going through, what would we say, a major flux over the last couple of years, right? So if you visited these places maybe 3 or 4 years ago, there was democracy. It wasn't going particularly well because they had lots of Islamist insurgencies and various different civil strife and civil wars and various different things going on, and the military in these three countries decided, okay, well, democracy isn't working, it's not dealing with this situation, so we're going to take over. And that's exactly what they did, right? So all of these countries, Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, are run by military juntas.
Yeah.
And that is annoying people in the neighbourhood, okay, countries like Ghana, Nigeria, so on, right? And these three countries were members of what is called ECOWAS, right? The Economic Community of West African States, but they left that last year, right? And they set up their own alliance called the Alliance of Sahel States. Began as a military alliance, but now they're trying to, you know, work together to create an economic community. And part of that economic community is apparently imposing levies on other countries in the area to try and, you know, lower the price of their goods, and they'll trade with each other. So that's what's going on there. So they announced it on Friday, and it took effect immediately, and it will affect all goods from outside the three countries, but not humanitarian aid, which okay, probably shows the state of the countries, the state that they're in at the moment. They're not in good shape.
Now, 0.5% isn't a huge tariff.
Not as big as some we've heard recently, all
no.
right.
So I assume, especially countries that would border these countries, are any of them annoyed by it or retaliating in any way?
So the reaction to it has been so far from ECOWAS, journalists, you know, put in requests to see what the response was, and they sent out a spokesperson to say that ECOWAS has convened a special meeting for April 22nd. So ECOWAS are sort of going, okay, yeah, now it's terrible, but we're going to take our time with this. This is no problem. And all of their dealings so far have been pretty much like that, right? So they've put economic pressure on these three countries to, first of all, to come back to democracy. Mm. These three countries responded by saying, you can sod your democracy, we're leaving ECOWAS. They said, okay, off you go. Whenever you want to come back, come back. So I think that the strategy here is, okay, you can deal with the leaders, the military leaders and all that kind of thing on a different level. But the message that you have to keep giving to the people, or the people that are listening at least, or can listen, I don't know what the communications are like there or the media, is we're here for you when these military juntas are gone and they've taken all the money with them or whatever. So yeah. I think that's the message that's being sent. It's measured.
Yeah. The standard of living in these three countries wouldn't be fabulous,
well,
I take it.
Desperate. Yeah. And it has gone down because of the insurgencies and the level of violence that they have to deal with here. Which, there's no doubt about it, even when there was democratic governments there and even when the French were there, it was out of control. But I don't know if it's improved that much since the military juntas have come together, even though they are cooperating with each other on these different levels.
Yeah. Right. Italy, we're going to go to next, and a rather grim case of the murder of two young women, murdered within 24 hours of each other.
Yeah, well, it appears that at least the stories broke within sort of a day or 2 days of each other. And it's you know, drawn a response from people within Italy. Now, Italians would be great for going out and protesting anyway, but this has seen, you know, numbers somewhat unprecedented. So the two stories in this situation involve two 22-year-old women, okay? One, a woman by the name of Sara Campanella. She was a 22-year-old biomedical student. She was studying in the University of Messina, which is in Sicily. She was stabbed in broad daylight, waiting for a bus. A man by the name of Stefano Argentino, 27, who was also a student at the university. He's been arrested. Apparently, he has already admitted his guilt and admitted what he had done. And according to the prosecutor and to other reports that I've read, he was basically hassling her and stalking her for the last 2 years. She had told her friends that she was dealing with it and everything was fine, but he obviously wasn't getting the response that he wanted or that he felt he should have got, whatever. And this is how he dealt with it. And so that was Sarah's end, unfortunately. And then a couple of hours later, the body of another 22-year-old woman, a woman by the name of Ilaria Sulla. She was a student at La Sapienza, which is a university I know well because I went there. And her body was found in a forested area outside of the Italian capital on Wednesday morning, just after that other death in Messina. So the two stories came together. It's the 11th femicide in Italy this year. So women there rightfully are annoyed and they're expressing that. And there's been calls for what one MP called a cultural rebellion in the country. And they could probably do with it, all right. And not just at this level, but on, you know, the lower street level with the catcalling and the hissing and all that stuff that still goes on there, which is just, you know, groups of lads hanging around.
So 11 this year, how many were there last year?
Last year, there were 113 femicides and 99 were committed by relatives, partners or ex-partners. The total number of murders in Italy in 2024, men, women, whatever you want, 319. So over a third of those were women and almost a third of those were committed by people they knew.
Yeah, OK. Of course, people will be texting and saying that means two thirds are of men. That's another debate. Right, Trinidad and Tobago we're going to go to now. And homophobia in Trinidad, someone's trying to take it on.
Yeah, so this was actually, this is a follow-on for us from a story that we actually reported on in April 17th, 2018, Sean, would you believe, right? It rang a bell me, right? And back then in 2018, Jason Jones, who's an LGBT activist, he brought a case to the Constitutional Court saying that, quote unquote, a buggery law that had criminalised consensual sex between men since 1925 was unconstitutional, right? So we've seen this kind of thing before where the British brought in these laws, then they left and this law stayed in place.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in 2018, the Constitutional Court agreed with them and they tried to remove the law. They actually didn't remove it completely, but they amended it to take out the consent side of it. So they said it was okay that consenting adults participated in this activity.
Okay.
But it wasn't okay if there was no consent, right? So they kept it there, but they changed the parameters of it, right? And the judge at the time said that every citizen of Trinidad must be free to make decisions as to whom he or she loves. Straight away, the government appealed the decision. And 7 years later, that's how long it took, okay, the appeal court has come back with its ruling and has said that judges cannot change the law. We give effect to Parliament's intentions. So therefore, buggery remains a crime in Trinidad and Tobago. And that's what they've done. So they've recriminalised
sex amendment about consent is now gone. And so
that's an interesting question, right?
Yeah.
That's an interesting question. That amendment about, I don't know, to be honest with you. I assume it has. I assume they will revert back to the pre-existing law. But in fact, it's a good question because this is part of Jason Jones, the guy who took the original case. This is part of his argument. Of course, he's going to fight it further on, right? So he can go to the Privy Council in London, which is ultimately the place that makes the decisions, right? Now, he's saying that the government's argument here was that they won the case under what's called a savings clause. A savings clause was brought in just before they switched from being under the British to independence. And it basically allowed for a smooth transition, right, from British colonial law to independence, right? Mm. So it said, keep your laws. They can only be amended really by by Parliament.
Yeah.
Okay. You can't go to a constitutional court and change the laws. Parliament has to okay it, right? So what he's saying is, this legislation was in fact altered three times since 1962, right? It was altered in 1976, 86 and 2000. So he's saying that actually this law dating back to 1925 doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah.
So it doesn't qualify under this savings clause.
Yeah.
So therefore, we're not really scrapping that law. We're scrapping the new laws post 1962 that were amended. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Is this law enforced at all?
No, it's not. It should be said. But this was something that...
No, I know it's not the point, and yeah, certainly not the point he'd be making.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really enforced. And that is something that the judge in the appeal, who found in favour of the government, actually said.
Mm.
Right? He said, look, this isn't enforced. However, it should be said that the amendment to the law in 2000, okay, for example, so I said three times it was amended, it increased the sentences from 10 years to 25 years.
Huh.
So there's very much a sentiment, or there's political profit to be made from going against the overturning of these laws. Does that make sense?
Yes.
There's a conservative base there. So there's about 1.4 million people live in Trinidad and Tobago. They have some cities there, but they're not very big. In the cities, quite liberal. Outside of the cities, not so liberal.
Mm.
And that's where you get a kind of a concentration of your voter base. And that's who many people in the government would be appealing to. So it's kind of pandering to them. And that's why the government appealed. So we'll have to see where it goes.
Right. Sweden we're going to go to next. And this is a story about a couple who run a lovely Swedish eco-retreat. You know, it's the sort of thing people would be all over it on Instagram.
Yeah, they sure would.
Yeah.
But it's no longer there, unfortunately. So this is a Danish chef couple who ran this forest resort in Sweden. It's in Halland in southern Sweden. They had 16 wooden cottages on a lake, and it was all, you went there to sort of, you know, free yourself from the rat race. It was called Steadsands, but they're no longer there because it appears that they've scarpered. And the reason that they've scarpered, allegedly, is because they owe money to the Swedish authorities, approximately 550,000 euros. Now, originally, as I said, they're Danish, okay? They ran a restaurant in Denmark, but in 2016, they said they felt the call of the wild, and so they moved to Sweden. It turns out they actually also got a call from Danish tax authorities who they owed money to. So they were going from Denmark because they owed money to Sweden, where they now own money. And the whole thing in this eco-friendly retreat is now bankrupt, apparently. So they've popped up in Guatemala, according to this investigation that was done by two newspapers. And they're running some sort of a hotel in Guatemala.
Oh, my word. Now, they didn't pay their tax, but they did leave something behind for the authorities.
They did. They left behind 158 barrels of human waste, which the other... I wasn't expecting that response, which the authorities are not too happy about. But you never know. There might be some sort of gold in them, their barrels in some way.
And this resort they had was just like wooden cottages type
very
job.
Swedish looking.
Yeah. But, and so people were maybe using the loo and didn't realise what was happening.
I don't know now if there was anything
ins and outs of it kind of thing.
Where you were getting mud baths, and it was actually, I don't even want to go there, Sean, to be honest with you. But
And they're in Guatemala, did you say?
Apparently.
Yes. Can Sweden or Denmark do anything about this now? Or are they just, you know, presumably they went there because that's beyond the reach of those two countries?
I don't know, to be honest with you. That's the one time I didn't check if there was a deal between the countries. I don't know if they can be brought back. I mean, even if the Danish tax authorities, I would assume, were trying to get them, and they were only up the road in Sweden.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and they were finding it difficult. So I don't know the ins and outs of it. But anyway, just keep an eye out just in case you're going to Guatemala.
Yeah, if you do find out the name of that hotel in Guatemala, just so I think people should know, just to be on the safe side. From all points of view. Now, I suppose this is a story that affects many countries, really, but particularly countries that might have uncontacted peoples and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so this is a story specific to an island Which is only 60 square kilometers in size, okay? And if you take into consideration that Louth is about 125 square kilometers, that'll show you how small it is, okay? Yeah. It's in the Bay of Bengal. It's called the North Sentinel Island. And a young man, an American by the name of Mikhailo Polyakov, 24-year-old, he's a social media influencer, he has decided that he wants to get to this island and he wants to make contact with the tribe that lives here who do not want to be contacted. And if you want an indication of how they're letting people know that they do not want to be contacted, there was a man who landed there in November of 2018. He is now dead.
Yeah, okay.
He was killed by them the minute he landed there. They don't want anybody there, okay? And legally, the Indian government, I think, who look after this, have an area around it of 5 kilometres that you're not actually allowed to enter into. So what did this guy do? He went in his boat. I don't know what type of a boat it was, but he went in his boat. He sat in the boat for an hour blowing a whistle in order to try and get their attention. Wasn't satisfied that he wasn't getting their attention, decided to go onto the beach, and he was there only for about 5 minutes, but he left a can of Coke, a coconut, took some samples, made a video and put it up on social media. Hey, look at me. Mm. Now, he was arrested and he's gone before a court. He's been remanded for 3 days for further questioning, I believe. I don't know what could happen to him or what kind of a sentence he could get, to be honest with you. But a lot of people are very annoyed about this. In particular, a group called Survival International, who I'm sure you're aware of.
We've talked to them, yeah.
Good group. They do a lot of good work. And they're basically saying stuff like this is just not on. And they're saying that social media influencers pose a new and increasing threat for uncontacted indigenous tribes who just don't want to be contacted. Leave them alone.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not just this particular chap, though. This might turn into a thing. And I think we have seen...
I think there's been other cases before where people have gone and you know, tried to get in touch or to do stupid things. And it's really dangerous. I mean, the evidence of that is the guy who's also an American, John Allen Chow. He got there in November 2018. He was killed. But, you know, you come into contact with these people. They haven't been exposed to measles, mumps, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
You could wipe them out. So it's just not something that needs to be done.
Right. What should we look out for over the next week or so?
Yeah, lots of things coming up. There's a small thing about tariffs, more tariffs coming in tomorrow. This is April. Is tomorrow actually Liberation Day or was that last week?
I think that was the announcement Liberation Day. I don't know what you call tomorrow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then on Wednesday, same day, M23 rebels and the DRC government are expected to hold talks in Doha. That's good news. Hopefully they come up with some sort of a... conclusion, or at least the road to peace in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, because it's needed. It's in chaos there. On Wednesday also, Camilla and Charles will celebrate their 20th wedding anniversary.
Is it 20 years? That shot passed. That really did.
Yeah, they must be very happy. God, and
they've
making
got
the
to
rest
send
of
them a card
well.
And everything.
Yeah, they're in Italy actually at the moment. Nice. So they're celebrating that. And then on Thursday, the Coalition of the Willing, that is the new Coalition of the Willing, not the one from George W. Bush's time, those defence ministers will meet on Brussels, as I said, on Thursday.
Okay. Jonathan, thanks a million.
Thanks,
as ever. Jonathan DeBurka Butler there.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.